I'm local, you can tell, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Born and raised. Born and raised, wanting to stay.
That accent, that's
that is, it is, yeah, it is. Bellingham. It's a Bellingham accent, you're exactly right. Uncanny how you picked that up.
Okay, well, welcome to the second edition of Podcast for Good. I cannot believe they're letting us do this a second time. That's awesome. We didn't already get shut down by everybody. Let me introduce myself. I'm Philip Kerrigan, Program Manager of the Combined Fund Drive, and this is...
Heather Lucas, Fiscal and Policy Coordinator for the Combined Fund Drive.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I mean, good job.
Yeah, thank you. I couldn't remember what my title was for a second.
That's funny.
Yep.
Podcast Extraordinaire should be your title.
Boom.
Our main goal behind these podcasts is to introduce people to charities that are doing really great work in our communities and do it in such a way where we talk about topical issues that are happening. So we decided this week to pick a light topic in celebration of World Refugee Day that happened on June 20th. World Refugee Day, we decided to actually go to the International Rescue Committee, who is essentially one of the biggest organizations here in Washington State that deal with what's called recommitment, which is essentially taking refugees from the places they initially fled to and integrating them into the United States. And we thought, what better way to kind of talk about World Refugee Day than to go talk to a member charity that actually deals with refugees. Heather and I want to kind of preface a couple of things before we get started. First and foremost, this is not meant to be a political podcast. So we are, even though we delve into that sort of stuff a little bit, you can't avoid it with some of these topics. The Combined Fund Drive is an apolitical organization. And our intention is to merely basically talk above the politics, honestly, and talk about the actual issue surrounding the problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the other thing we want to do is make a distinction between refugees and immigration.
Yes.
They actually, people think they're one and the same. They're actually quite different. Heather, can you explain the difference between what a refugee is and what an immigrant is?
There is a UN definition, United Nations definition for what a refugee is. And a refugee is someone who's fled his or her home and country of origin due to a well-founded fear of persecution, and it's either because of race, religion.
Like gender identity, I believe, is one of them,
gender
right?
Gender identity, membership in a particular social group or political opinions.
Right.
And this was defined due to the United Nations 1951 Refugee Commission.
Okay.
So in 1951, there was a convention that came out that said that refugees need to be protected, and this is how the United Nations was going to do it, but it had limitations. So the protocol in 1967 removed limitations to allow like an all-encompassing coverage of people who were fleeing their homes. Mm-hmm. And people who are fleeing their homes, generally, it's because they need to save their lives.
Right.
It's not because they're looking for, say, an American dream, mm-hmm, or
right,
a better chance at life, where immigrants may be doing that. They're mm-hmm not fleeing persecution. They're not fleeing because of war or famine. They're immigrating from one country where they live to another for an opportunity at something better.
Right.
Whereas refugees, it's mostly to just save their lives and
right,
the lives of their families.
Right. Because refugees are basically doing the base sort of human reaction, which is to flee somewhere so that they can live.
Yeah.
That's a really important distinction to make.
Absolutely. And there are different types of displaced people, because refugees are considered displaced simply because they're leaving their homeland. But there's also asylum seekers. They're becoming a refugee because their claim to refugee status, it's not yet established in the country they fled to, so they're not considered a refugee at that point. They're just an asylum seeker. Mm-hmm. Internally displaced persons, they're people who, let's say, if in Washington State, we had war breakout in Olympia, and
whoa,
I know,
war in Olympia.
I know. Imagine that.
What's going to happen to Archibald's sisters?
Oh, Archibald's sisters. So, if there was something like a war in Olympia, and we fled to save our lives to Spokane, we would be internally displaced.
Mm-hmm.
They're also stateless persons. They don't have a recognized nationality. They don't belong technically to any country, and they usually don't have any kind of ID or certificate saying, hey, you're born and this is who you are. Very rare. The returnee is what they call it, is a refugee who has returned home.
Let's talk a little bit about World Refugee and actual give some of the facts and figures surrounding refugees in general before we dive into the interview. So what exactly is World Refugee Day besides something that Google gets to say that they celebrate?
Yeah, they do have nice art on these days.
Yes, they do.
So World Refugee Day, like we said, it's June 20th. It's an annual day. The day itself was declared in December of 2000. So there was no actual celebration of it, which is more like a celebration is kind of a weird word to me. It's more like an awareness of...
Yeah, like a recognition
exactly.
of whatever, yeah.
Yeah, so more than anything, it's celebrated because it's to support millions of families all over the world who have lost their homes and families because of violence or war. Mm-hmm. And it is also serving to remind people about failures of an international community or home conflicts which forced their families to leave. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a crazy day to celebrate, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's necessary to have people who are just living their everyday lives and untouched by war mm-hmm. and a refugee crisis to recognize this is happening in the world.
Right.
Like, it happens mm-hmm. to smart people.
Yeah.
It happens to children. Like, 50% of refugees are under the age of 18.
Yeah.
So children are heavily affected.
Right.
The International Rescue Committee, they were founded in 1933 on recommendation from Albert Einstein, who is a famous refugee fleeing Nazi Germany.
Yeah. What we also dove into a little bit to give everybody here a sense of history regarding refugees is we took a look back at the different instances of influxes in refugees into this particular country, and then we narrowed it down to also Washington State. So some of the sort of past influxes of refugees that have happened in this country, really, we'll just go back to the 1840s because, I mean, really, who cares about anything before the 1840s? Just kidding, history buffs. Please stay tuned. In the 1840s and 50s, of course, we had Irish Catholic refugees. That's an important distinction because there were already many Irish Protestant refugees who were already here. The Irish Catholic refugees were mostly from poorer parts of the country. They fled because of potato famine. And at the time, there were more than 3 million people who came to America in just a decade.
Crazy.
Yeah. They were, of course, met with resistance, as many sort of refugee groups often see. In particular, there was a group called the Know Nothing Political Party. These were folks who, if you've ever seen the movie Gangs New York, they are the bad guys in Gangs New York. Then in the 1930s, another sort of very, very recognized group of refugees that came in were actually Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Germany, Albert Einstein, you know, chief among them.
Yeah.
In the 1960s and 70s, the Vietnamese quote-unquote boat people, which were the folks who were fleeing the oppressive communist government in Vietnam, and then also fleeing the horrors of that particular war. So there was a huge influx there. In fact, here in Washington State, that was actually the large bulk of folks who they saw for a long period of time who were refugees. In the 80s, it was Cuban refugees fleeing the same sort of oppressive government. And in the 90s, it was Haitian refugees who came into the United States because that place was unfortunately just a complete disaster from top to bottom in terms of politics and oppression and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
65 million folks are currently either internally displaced, as Heather kind of talked about, where they just moved within the country.
Yeah.
And unfortunately have no protections at that point. They just moved. Mm-hmm. And folks who are refugees or asylum seekers who literally went across borders. Of those 65 million people, as Heather alluded to, more than half are under the age of 18. 40 million are considered internally displaced, so they're just families who moved out of their homes and into other portions of the country in which they live. This is kind of interesting. I didn't know this. The actual country that has the most internally displaced people at this moment is actually Colombia, with 7.6 million.
It's slightly insane.
Yeah.
You don't think about a place like Colombia. It's not something that's in the news.
Right. Well, that's kind of what was so interesting to me when we went over this information. Like, we always just see the ones that are on the news. So yeah. We see Syria as this sort of, like, hot cauldron. And we see, you know, places like in the Middle East. But you're talking about the Democratic Republic, the Congo,
yeah.
Burma, Colombia.
Nigeria.
Nigeria. These yeah. are places that aren't even on our map
yeah.
where people are suffering quite a bit.
Yeah.
And to the point where they make really crucial decisions that they basically would rather flee the country than actually stay another minute. Here in the United States in 2016... nearly 85,000 refugees entered the country. So if you take a look at the math, that means that refugees only made up really 0.1% of all the refugees in the entire world.
Which is definitely something that is not being said in the media.
Right.
Yeah, the way that rhetoric goes, it does sound like we are inundated with refugees.
Right. Right.
And we're not.
And the reality is, in talking, what was really cool in talking with the folks at the IRC is that actually the developed world only has allowed 140,000 refugees actually in their borders.
Yeah.
And given them the proper sort of asylum and all those sort of things. To have the United States be responsible for 2/3 of those refugees, to me, really points to a country that is still generous, that is still willing to help people, that is still willing to bring them in.
Absolutely.
And give them a better life. And I think that that's really cool. I don't think that's another thing that's talked about very often.
Yeah.
Refugees are profoundly different than immigrants, and they only make up about 10%.
Yeah, refugees are technically immigrants, but immigrants are not always refugees.
Right. The Migration Policy Institute and the International Rescue Commission both have said that because of this sort of general geographic location and sort of the strict vetting policies, the United States will probably never see the sort of influx that is currently happening.
Yeah, it's probably the easiest thing for a refugee to do is to walk, because you don't have access to the things, the material things that you did in your life. Like, if you're in a war zone, maybe your home was bombed, your car is gone, maybe you didn't have a car to begin with. So you have no option but to walk on foot out of the war zone, and next door is probably the closest and safest place.
That's exactly right. To keep it totally local, right here in Washington State. So according to that same UN refugee agency, Washington State is actually among the top 10 in receiving immigrants, or refugees, excuse me. So they're in the top 10. For receiving refugees. That's pretty unbelievable. In the last 2 years, 4,100 people have resettled to Seattle and the outlying areas.
Yeah.
We've seen, they have actually done the studies. We've seen different areas come in and sort of, it fluctuates in terms of country of origin. Most folks are coming from, actually, again, this is so surprising, the Ukraine.
Of all places.
Of all places, yeah. Right? And then followed by Burma and Somalia.
Yeah, you don't hear that there are any refugee issues happening in Ukraine or Burma or Somalia at all.
Yeah.
Like, when people think of Somalia, they think, like, 1994.
Right.
That's when there was a big crisis.
Right.
Not that there's still a crisis.
Yeah. It reminds you, really, of sort of how vast the world is.
Yeah.
And how much, if you think you know, you don't really know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it just reminds you of how big the world is and how small we still really are. And I think that we have to remember that we don't nail it with all the knowledge that we have. We can continue to learn more about places and different cultures and challenges that people have.
You know?
And the two sort of places that refugees settle into most are actually Tukwila and Kent. Close to 4% of both cities' populations are actually refugees. You don't want to hear us talk the whole time. So we're actually going to go ahead and toss it to the interview with Nikki Smith, who's the executive director of the International Rescue Committee, and Borka Popajek, who is the reception and placement manager there. She is a refugee herself from Bosnia-Herzegovina in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
She had a really interesting perspective on things. Let's toss it over to that interview, and we hope you enjoy. We're here with Borka Popenchak, is that correct?
Uh-huh.
You are the reception and placement manager for International Rescue Committee. Mm-hmm. And then we are also here with Nikki Smith, who's the executive director of all of Seattle, or like just here in SeaTac? I mean, the whole thing?
All of Washington.
Oh, all right. Wow.
But we're only in SeaTac. We have aspirations for more.
Awesome. How long have you guys been an organization, both nationally and then as a local chapter?
First of all, ISC was founded in 1933, so we've been around for a very long time. We were founded at the request of Albert Einstein, and during that time it was because lots of people were in fleeing Nazi Germany, whether they were Jews or gypsies or political activists, and so we really started our time during a period of crisis.
Right.
And it was really recognized by many here, and Albert Einstein himself was a refugee, which is important to remember. And he was in the United States, and he said, you know, it's really time that we did something. And so the IRC sent this incredible guy called Varian Fry over to Europe, and he had a number of visas that helped people leave. And he was based in, at that point, it was Vichy-occupied France in Marseille. And then when he was there, he recognized there were a lot more people who needed help than he had visas for.
Mm-hmm.
So he essentially, and with a number of others, set up a ways and means for people to leave Europe. Not so legally.
Yeah.
But it was a crisis time. And so that's, we were started then, and then we've essentially been around since then. And so now we are an agency that works in more than 30 different countries.
Wow.
Around the world. And we have 29 offices in the United States, where we resettle refugees on behalf of the United States government.
And how long have you guys been out here in the Washington area?
So we started up, this is our 41st year. So last year we celebrated our 40th anniversary, and I've been here since February of last year, so Borka has a lot more information about the past than I do.
So I started with the IRC in October of 1996. And I came to United States as a refugee myself, mm-hmm. from Bosnia and Herzegovina, mm-hmm. in April of the same year, and I got the job, and ever since I've been helping people and, you know, doing the resettlement work.
Yeah.
And I am aware, and I know all, not all, but many of the issues that newly arrived are facing.
Great.
Right after the arrival and a long time, when they settle down, it's still the issues that needs assistance and help with.
So over 40 years, we've resettled more than 20,000 refugees in and around the Seattle area. We say Puget Sound because sometimes most is in King County, but some in Pierce and some in Snohomish.
Yeah, I was reading something that said that Washington State is among the top 10 states in receiving refugees.
That's right. So last year, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, Washington was the fourth largest state for receiving refugees.
Wow.
And, you know, what's crazy is that if you looked in the previous fiscal year, we were the 10th.
Wow.
So, you know, Washington is definitely showing its heart as being a welcoming city, a welcoming state, rather.
What would account for that jump from 10th to 4th? Is there anything that points to that?
I think it's the fact that more refugees were assigned here, perhaps less refugees were assigned to other, you know, there were other states that, for example, opted out of the refugee resettlement program. Texas was one of those, and Kansas and New Jersey were others. So whilst the governor opting out of the state refugee resettlement program it causes delays, it does not cause a stop.
I see.
What happens is the federal government works with other partners to determine another ways and means to coordinate the refugee resettlement. Mm. So I think that's what caused some of the downsize in other states.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And also Washington's a great state to be in.
Yeah. What does your organization, in a few different ways, what does it do for folks who are resettling?
So the resettlement process starts before the arrival of the refugees. As soon as we get the names of the families that are scheduled to arrive to Washington State, we start resettlement preparations. And it starts with getting them the affordable housing, which these days it's close to impossible.
Yeah, right.
But we are managing somehow. and then you prepare the file for the family arrival pickup. We have to prepare ready-to-eat food, hot meal,
right,
upon their arrival, set up the place where they are going to live, and we do it as decent as we can. We have the things that we are required to provide, and then we try to put in, to throw in some luxurious things to make them welcome, and, you know, nice tablecloth, placemats, flower pot or something, you know. Then we meet the family at the airport, and we make sure we have the language there. So if it's family, Iraqi family, we want to have someone who speaks Arabic so they don't feel bad when they come and they're not able to speak. And, you know, we transport them to their homes and do the first step, which is home safety orientation. So you take them through their house, show them there are many things that I didn't know when I came, how to turn the stove on, how to turn the shower, how to start the dishwashing machine, how to lock, safety things. And then you follow them from that moment onwards for 90 days is required, but we do it much, much longer because they need assistance and help. We help them with enrolling their kids in school, referring them to English classes, to job classes, applying for social security cards, applying for benefits, everything that's needed, health screening, medical appointments. In Washington State is famous for excellent children medical system. So all the sick kids with really serious conditions, we take them all. We never said no to our processing unit in New York for the sick child. That's a very noble job that I'm happy to do. So, yeah, it's extensive. It's a lot of work.
Right.
But at least in, you know, a year or two, you can see them thriving, especially those who have nice jobs, driving, planning on buying the home. It makes your heart fill with pride.
When a family comes here and you start that process, when you're bringing them from the airport to their home and you have the 90 days, how much longer do you think on average for each family you stay with them?
At least a year.
Okay.
Even they come to you with all sorts of questions. They will take their mail from the mailbox and come to you to sort it out, which we never mind.
Sure.
Because they can, you know, there are spam mails, there are all these publisher house, clearing house things that we want them to avoid.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you are teaching them.
We also have other programs.
Yeah.
So Borka is talking about the very initial reception and placement program.
Core.
But we have other programs, for example, the employment program. We also run a youth program. And so with the youth children and youth program, we actually work with 3 school districts. And we run summer school and a summer camp because many of our kids, you know, then they've never had formal education. You know, when your country has been impacted by war, it means everything is impacted, everything is disrupted. So schools are often stopped because, you know, parents don't want to send their children to school if bombs are being dropped or there's fear of insecurity because your child might not come back from school.
Yeah.
So often schools are closed. Even if they've been in a refugee camp and had school, you know, the school is not the same as, you know, in the United States. It doesn't have computers because there's no electricity. Children are not used to sitting for 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day in a formal classroom. So we work with the kids, but we also work with the teachers, helping them understand some of the needs of the kids when they come in. So, you know, we work with upwards of 5 years for families that are around for that. So some of our other programs, it means that we're able to extend our services, which is always our vision and our dream, is that, you know, that we can provide as much support to families when they're here as possible.
What are sort of the largest populations that you guys have dealt with here in this area in terms of populations?
So if I was to ask you, how many refugees in the world are there? Would you know the answer?
Pre my research, I would have told you it's like millions.
I would have said like 100 million. I would have guessed.
Something astronomical. Yeah.
So it's 21.3 million, and that was estimated in 2015.
Wow.
All right.
So 2016 is we're going to see a big uptick in that number.
Right.
And that number is established by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, and they do an extensive report. So 21.3 million refugees, and those are just refugees, not displaced, which is you know, internally displaced people, which is more than 65 million people displaced in the world right now.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Unprecedented numbers. And I wish, and I'm an eternal optimist. I'm like Mary Poppins. So mm-hmm. I wish I could say that we were going in a good trajectory, but we're not. You know, we're going to see a lot more numbers. Mm. So if I was to ask you a second question, and I always find this interesting, pop quiz, right? How many people do you think got the opportunity to be resettled around the world last year to a new country? Not just the United States, to other countries.
Out of that 21 million?
Out of that 21 million.
Like half?
I don't know. I would say a lot less, like 1 million.
140,000 people.
Oh, my gosh.
That's sad.
140,000. And the United States is responsible for 80,000?
Two-thirds of that went to the United States.
Wow.
So, you know, you're kind of causing an issue, right? That if you've got a lot of people coming in and not many people leaving, you know, it creates an issue. So, you know, I'm an American now, but I'm British born. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Europe sees a lot of, God, look at all the refugees in Europe. It's crazy how many, you know, refugees are there. Look how many refugees there are in America. And I say, you know, but guess who hosts the world's most amount of refugees? And people never guess. It's Turkey. But, you know, Turkey right now is host to 2.5 million refugees.
Wow.
Pakistan is the host to 1.6 million refugees. Lebanon is the host to 1.1. Iran to 1 million. Jordan to half a million. Kenya to half a million. You know, so if you look at those numbers, one country that doesn't appear here is like, oh, no Germany. Mm-hmm. Nope, no UK, no US. Mm-hmm. Three quarters of the world's refugees are actually in developing countries. They're being hosted in those countries. And then the other crazy statistic is that more than half the world's refugees come from three countries.
Really?
Yeah. So it is Syria, it is Afghanistan, and it is Somalia. So 140,000 people as refugees being resettled to a third country is really not very many. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the major issues is that since the Cold War, we haven't really come up with solutions for refugee crisis.
So a refugee essentially will flee their current country, mm-hmm. most likely to the nearest country they can possibly find,
exactly.
nearest port they can find.
Yeah.
And of those millions who go in those other in those neighboring countries, you're talking only 150,000 of those folks end up being able to emigrate, if you will, or become refugees.
Absolutely. Yes.
In a more developed country.
Yeah. Yes. So the UN has basically a strategy on working with refugees, and it's called the Durable Solutions. And the first part of the Durable Solution is it safe for this family to return to their country of origin? And that's called voluntary repatriation, right? Mm-hmm. But it has to be based on choice. Right? That is really important because you don't want to just forcibly close camps and send people back to peril. So what happens is there's a part of a program where people can return there and say, is it safe? And these are, I always say, this is what refugees are looking for all around the world. Is it safe for me and my family?
Yeah.
Is there schooling for my children? Mm-hmm. And can I earn a living? Mm-hmm. Those are the three things they're always looking for, whether it's in the United States, returning to their country of origin, or where they fled to, yeah. right? If you can't return, and many people can't return, because it might be that you're continuous, you know, there's still an issue for why you left. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's your gender or sexual identity. Maybe it's your religion, whatever it might be.
Right.
So the second one is, well, can you integrate into the place that you fled to? And so often there are local laws that prevent that. So what happens is that many nations work to try and advocate for change for those laws.
Sure.
And then the third one is, for the very lucky few, and that's less than 1%, it's third country resettlement.
I always get the sense that, like, history has shown that there is this backlash when a refugee group comes in. People kind of react very viscerally. We don't want them here. But I don't think that anybody's ever taken into account that perhaps the actual person who's a refugee would much prefer to live in their country of origin if it were peaceful. Does that seem like something you found?
Yeah. I would rather be in my country. It's, you know, same language, tradition that you know, culture that you know. If you can make the living, if the schools are good, mm-hmm. and if it is safe.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. Do you think the developed world has done enough for refugees around the world?
I think sometimes there's a lack of political will to resolve crises, and that's what causes a refugee movement is because of conflict or because of persecution, right? So wouldn't it be wonderful if we could resolve these seemingly intractable issues in some of these countries, which will stop, you know, turn the tap off, the spigot off, right?
Yeah. Right.
Because people are leaving because of they're fearful of their lives, the right. lives of their family. Mm-hmm. It's not that they are looking for a better job. You know, I always argue that, you know, Syrians putting their children on boats and crossing a really dangerous body of water is not so that they can earn more money and have a better job. They feel like their children are more likely to die in Syria than they are on the journey fleeing the country. That's a really tough decision to make.
Can you walk us through the process of how a person who's a refugee mm-hmm. would enter into this country and then begin a settlement process? Like, mm-hmm. what are the steps that they have to do?
You left your country. Mm-hmm. You are now in the second country, living there and trying to get approved for a resettlement. You have to go through certain criteria to be accepted. There are agencies who are approving who has good case of who can get refugee status. And the main reason to get the status is if you are in fear for your life if you go back to your country. If they find you eligible, then you start your resettlement process. You have to fill in the forms, and then it takes time, usually between year and two, if you are lucky. But for some people in Kenya, Ethiopia, it takes years. We resettled people who lived in the camp all their lives. Like,
wow.
Yeah, Bhutanese.
Wow.
Case worker of ours. Wow. He's born in Bhutan, and he spent 22 years in the camp before
wow.
coming to the United States. Or we just resettled Somali family. They were in camp for 16 years before getting the green light
wow.
to
wow.
travel.
And not
yeah.
every refugee is eligible for resettlement.
Yeah, no. Ooh.
What happens to those refugees who are not eligible for resettlement? They end up just staying in the camp, essentially.
Yeah, so it goes back to that point about the durable mm-hmm. solutions, because UNHCR recognizes that there's only a finite amount of people that can be resettled to a third country. Mm-hmm. So then can they return to their country of origin? Remember, that was the voluntary repatriation.
Mm-hmm.
Or can they be integrated into the country that they fled to?
It's clear that refugees face a ton of challenges, because whenever anybody has to leave their home, like, you have just material aspects. What do I take? What do I do? What are the biggest challenges that you guys deal with when it comes to refugees? What are their biggest challenges?
The basics, even transportation, is a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
To get a driver's license is a challenge. To understand education system in America is a challenge. It was for me. You know, the grades, the grading, GPAs, I had no clue what that means. The kids would come back with those report cards and you didn't know how to read it.
Right.
You know,
right.
those are just the little things that impact all your life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When to look for a job, how to find a job, how to improve your language, a bunch of things. How to address medical issues, you know, how to take medication, how to, when you go to Target, you are not supposed to push that door that they will go back automatically by itself. You
yeah.
know, things
yeah.
like how to drink the water from that little water fountain. You would look in that, and I remember myself. It was so funny.
Were you waving at it?
Yeah, we saw people drinking, and my husband and I, we stopped next to it, and then I tried this, pushed from all sides, no water. And there is that. You
yeah.
know, thing across the
yeah.
silly
yeah.
things,
mm-hmm.
you would think. But if you never had a chance to use them, that's, you know, a lot of challenges.
Yeah, completely foreign
yeah.
to you at that point.
I would also, yeah, I would also add, you know, it's imagine that you've, because you've got no identity in the country
yeah.
that you've been taken to,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's suddenly like, you know, imagine yourself being dropped into Senegal. And then it's told, okay, so tomorrow you have to get your kids into school, you have to get a job, you have to open a bank account, you've got to try and figure out the public transport system,
yeah.
mm-hmm. and on top of that, you've got to demonstrate that you've got good credit history.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And by the way, they speak a local dialect. Do you know that dialect? So, you like, so how would you navigate that? And
right.
I think the credit history thing is also really tough, because so much of our life is around, what's your credit history? What's your FICO score,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So these are people like who, like I came into the United States 10 years ago, I had great credit history in Europe. Somehow that doesn't translate when it comes to the United States. So it's like I'd been born as a, you know, 36-year-old woman as in America, right? Oh, I'm a newborn person at the age of 36. So, yeah, I had no identity here. And you've got to quickly demonstrate that. Because otherwise, if you want to take a loan out for a car, you know, you're penalized for that because you don't have a credit history, you know, all of these things. Every credential that you might have got, you know, whether you're an engineer or a doctor.
That's the saddest part, I think.
That is the saddest part. And I think the saddest part is actually for America, you know, because these are really accomplished people that really want to contribute and participate. And so now you have, you know, a doctor as a janitor or a doctor as a working as a housekeeper in a hotel, or, you know, it just feels like such a loss of skill set.
Right. What would we have to do to change that? I mean, I'm sure it's a ton of stuff that has to happen because it would go through the government essentially, but like how do you allow people who are still as this qualified person to remain that qualified person?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I think, you know, some of it is about having the political will for it. So obviously, you know, is there something legislatively that can be done about this so that certain countries can be recognized? Now, I get it. Certain countries have not got a great track record. You know, I've got, hey, did you know I have a PhD from the University in Djibouti? You know, you might have some questions about that, right?
Yeah.
But there are certain countries where we do have strong relations, as you know, as the United States, where we should have agreements. You know, we are working in Iraq, for example, and I can tell you that having worked in Iraq, that the medical doctors there are very well qualified.
Yeah.
And so it seems strange that, you know, we would hire them as working for the US government in Iraq, but we wouldn't hire them working in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So we recognize their credentials in the country, but we don't recognize their credentials here. And I think if we can move the needle on that, I think what you would have is certainly a lot of very motivated people who want to work, are ready to work, and want to work at the level they had been working at before.
Yeah. Well, it would probably help people resettle their lives quicker as well.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly it. So I mean, it would be win-win.
Yeah.
There is a way to certify your diploma from your country, but it's costly. It takes time.
Mm-hmm.
For a doctor, let's say, it takes 3 years of studying, and you have to support your family. Of course, you cannot devote all your time to, you know, taking exams. My sister, she's a lawyer. She had 250 people under her. And then she came to the United States. Her first job was as a housekeeper in Four Seasons Hotel. She would go home crying for months. She would cry on the bus. No cars, nothing. I never drove in my country. No one to teach me. How am I supposed to pass the test? All these little things, you know, that.
So I have to tell you one story. So we had a client that met with us just a couple of weeks ago. And he said something that really remained with me. He said he's from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And he was forced to flee because of his gender identity, which is illegal for you to have a gender or sexual identity different from qualified as normal in Iran. Mm-hmm. So he would have been killed if he had stayed. And so he came to the United States and he said, so he works as a housekeeper. And he said, in my country, I would give tips to the housekeeper. And now I am the housekeeper receiving tips.
Wow.
So, and he said, I'm motivated because, and I'm not ashamed of that because I know that in 1 year's time, I will be giving tips to the housekeeper and thanking them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that remained with me because, you know, that is somebody who was had a different life, right? And there's nothing shameful about being a housekeeper. That's good, honest work. That's not where his skill set was.
Yeah.
And so why can't we use him at that skill set?
Right.
Well, and it's obvious, too. I don't think people think about it too much. But in coming to a different country, having all of that wiped away, like your life just ends, essentially. And you have to start over from this.
You are nobody. And you have to prove to everybody that you can be somebody.
And it can happen to everybody, right?
It can happen to everybody,
yeah. And do you find that refugees that come to the United States, let's say Washington State specifically, do they resettle and stay here, or do they ever end up going home?
Majority, I would say 99% of the refugees is resettled in Washington State. They stay. And I think we are the agency of the biggest stay of refugees resettled here out of all IRCs and other cities. As we mentioned, Washington is the super, very welcoming state. And, you know, people are having good lives. Everything is beautiful here.
Yeah, of course, obviously.
The mountains, the lakes.
We are biased because we're
the people. People especially, that's the most important thing, that no one feels not welcome to Washington State.
And you had asked, you know, about the where people are from, you know, coming into the state. And I think that in some way answers your question about people returning.
Okay.
So, you know, over 40 years, I would say that we've seen a huge demographic shift. You know, 40 years ago, we started with the Vietnam crisis.
Right.
So the majority of people that we were resettling were Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, where we are today is the largest group coming in is actually for IRC is Afghan. But the largest group coming into Washington is actually Ukrainian. Now, this is the largest Ukrainian hub in the United States.
Right.
So
see, that's a surprise to me.
Right, yeah. This is a surprise for me because we don't resettle that many Ukrainians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although,
is it a conflict situation that people are leaving Ukraine for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And minor religious groups. From,
yeah. So
it's
both
conflict
and religious persecution.
I see.
So so they're like a twofer, persecution and violence.
Yeah.
So we have Afghanistan is our top group, Iraq is our second largest group, Somalia is our third, and actually this year Ukrainians are our fourth, and they're tied with Iran and Eritrea. The next in line is Congolese. We have resettled far fewer Congolese this year, and then it's Burmese. But if you were to look back even 4 years ago, you would have Burma up there and Bhutan
and
Nepal. You know, so it really, really changes. So if you look at most of those countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Ukraine, Iran, Eritrea, you know, Congo, Burma, there's conflict going in. There's conflict or persecution still going on in all those countries.
Right.
And they've been going on there for a sustained period. So remember, you know, we're talking about why do people leave somewhere? Security, schooling, and ability to earn money.
When you see spots like that, or you see spots even like Burma, which has had conflict for years.
And persecution.
Yeah. Do you see a future where, like, those places will literally be almost like ghost towns where... Like, unless these conflicts get fixed, these places are going to be empty. Solely of the people who fight, and that would be it, right? I mean, it seems like...
Well, people still have babies.
Yeah.
So there are, whilst there are, and believe me, there are a lot of babies in refugee camps.
Yeah.
While you have some people leaving, you don't have everybody that leaves.
Right.
Because not an entire country is hit by a conflict, right? So, for example, I was working in Nigeria. So Nigeria... fourth largest oil producing country for OPEC, right? Huge troop contributing country to the United Nations and home of the Boko Haram. So largest population in Africa as well, by the way. So when you look at what the conflict affected area in Nigeria, it's the northeast part of the country. The rest of the country, okay, in the south you've got general lack of law and order because of banditry, because it is oil, a lot of oil there. But the rest of the country is sort of, you know, general insecurity, but it's not like in the northeast. So you can have peace and insecurity all in one country at the same time because these countries are really big. People still remain and babies are still being born. And so, you know, it would be hard to, I think, empty out a country.
Sure. But that's where the internally displaced people come from.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Those are the internally displaced. Exactly. If you were to go back 10 years ago into 2005, you know, what we were seeing was that started to be the really, the numbers of refugees were way lower. And what you started to see then was a rise in numbers of internally displaced people. Because what happened was it was less about intrastate conflict and then more about interstate conflict. So in other words, it was less about states sort of fighting one another and more insecurity within the country.
Yeah.
So that was the rise of internal displacement.
Right.
And that started to be a new phenomena about, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. If you have a country that is predisposed to natural disasters, right, because their geographic location, like let's look at the Philippines, you know, that is really the heart of, and I worked in the Philippines after the typhoon, If you, that area of the world is predisposed to climate change.
Yeah.
There are a series of, there are archipelago countries, a series of islands, low-lying, you know, when you have a big wave or a typhoon coming through. But then if you have a weak existing government there with poverty and all the other aspects that go along with that, essentially what you have is you have a layering of an issue.
Okay.
So when you have weak governance or poor governance, which leads to insecurity and poverty and all those other things, because, you know, terrorism doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of underdevelopment. It comes out of, you know, poverty, right? I mean, Al-Qaeda and Taliban and Boko Haram, they've all come from countries with existing issues.
Yeah.
Right. Lack of education. I mean, we as aid workers in Afghanistan were a bigger threat than bulky, locked and loaded US military guy, because we bought education. And that was seen as a larger threat into Taliban than a soldier.
Right.
Because we were educating people and taking away their recruits and things like that.
Wow. Do you have any hope that we'll start seeing the world maybe react better to these sort of crises?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see hope in the results here locally with the individuals you impact?
One of the things that I enjoy the most is seeing people can take control of their own lives, right? It's so that they're in the driving seat. That, I think, is the most powerful thing for me. When someone is getting a job, when somebody is keeping that job, when someone is being promoted in that job, when a kid is graduating from school, going to university, getting a master's degree, you know, that is what success looks like. Being elected into a government position and representing their community. That is what success is.
When the kid predestined to die,
survives.
Gets healthy and survives. No one even expected they would live. But then here, at least 4 kids over the last year, right?
Yeah.
2 Burmese and 2 Iraqis.
So that's success.
Yeah, that's success.
And if we can play a small part in that,
yay!
Awesome. How do private donations help your guys' organization?
Oh, they're the best funds. I always say that. They're like, they make me giddy. So happy. So we often have very tight budgets. You guys work for a state government, so you know that we all run lean, mean machines, right? So there is not a lot of fat on the budgets. And in fact, often we run a budget that is running into deficit because we often struggle to get the funds that actually the program really needs to do the services. So by having these what we call unrestricted funds, which is these wonderful funds that we get from you guys and other supporters, is that we can do other activities. We can first of all fully fund the programs that we're doing, but then we can also try out new programs which we know are really needed, whether that's the senior program or whether it's a new program we're also looking at, which is family counseling. So these funds that we get, they help us start these kind of initiatives that, you know, we're able to start with some small investment money. We call it the seed money. And then we can take that to other places and get more funds and make them, you know, to take them to scale.
Well, Nikki Borka, thank you very much for being on the podcast. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Right. You are more than welcome. Thank you, guys.
All right. So that was Nikki and Borka talking about the International Rescue Committee. If you want to find out more about them and other organizations, you can go to the CFD website, click on search, pick International Relief and Development, and all the charities that are in that particular category will come up. One of the things I like about this podcast is we get to basically have excuses to like make our brains get bigger.
It's true, yeah. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it was really an awesome conversation. 2 compelling people with very different accents, by the way.
Yeah, that was nice. It was also surprising. I wasn't expecting accents.
Like right away, right out of the gate, I was like, oh, British, okay, here we are. but so what do you feel like, Heather, was one of the things you were most sort of surprised at?
I was really floored by the fact that an average refugee stay in a camp is 17 years.
Yeah.
That's a childhood. That's a lifetime.
That's bananas. 17 years. That's crazy.
Yeah, and that's one of those things, too, that you don't hear about. So when you think of refugees, you think, oh, well, it's somebody who's just going to be at this place, you know, a year later, then they're going to go back home or something, right? Everything's going to be fine. No, 17 years.
I know. It's just, that was really crazy. I thought that was really unbelievable. And then The thing that I found really sort of fascinating was really two. The first was how you're reminded of, like, the fact that we have so many things in our lives that these people just basically cut ties with right as they leave. I mean, they take the bare minimum. And the fact that the UN has these really strict, like, you get a knife and a fork, and this is what we can give you.
Yes.
Right? And you think about all the things that you would want to take with you when you flee, and sort of how you don't have that opportunity in those circumstances. Kind of interesting, mildly heartbreaking, was the stories of people who essentially their whole identity is erased once they decide to become a refugee. It really is a gamble for these people, because they live in a country where they have an identity. They're a doctor, they're this, they're that, they're a professional worker.
Yeah.
They went to school, they have degrees. They make a calculated decision to leave their home, to go to another place so that they can survive.
Yeah.
And they have to account for the fact that if they leave, there is a very good chance that they will essentially be reborn.
Yeah, life as they know it is over.
Yeah. They are not, they folks who come here, their degrees are often not recognized by the United States. You know, sometimes for good reason. Even Nikki pointed it out, you know, sometimes there are certain schools in certain areas where you say, well, you probably need more schooling. You're
a
doctor in your community, but not maybe ours. But there are folks who come here with who are seasoned, legitimately strong individuals.
Yeah, experience.
Who have lots of experience, and they essentially get nothing.
Yeah.
You know, they have to start over again. Stories of, like, 65-year-old doctors who are now janitors in this country because their degree didn't transfer over.
Yeah, none of the experience that they have, it makes a difference.
Yeah. Before we close, we're going to hit you with a couple of the upcoming events that are happening in the Combined Fund Drive. We just finished up our campaign leader trainings. We trained almost 100 volunteers. Really cool.
Yeah, super cool.
Yeah, and we will we'll be sending out online training guides from that training to everyone who's a campaign leader. Relay for Life is on June 23rd at Camachin Middle School.
Yeah, and is there anybody there who's dressing up in the funny costume?
Oh, shut up. Yes. Oh, my God. So I have agreed, foolishly, to be Cat in the Hat.
Yeah.
For this particular thing, because it's a Dr. Seuss theme. So for those of you who want to make it down and see a really horrible rendition of Cat in the Hat,
you're going to be so sweaty.
Oh my gosh. It's going to be like 1,000 degrees. The costume lady who I'm getting this from is going to absolutely hate me. She's never going to rent another costume out to me again. But there's also the L&I Golf Tournament on July 20th. It's during the afternoon, so you'd have to take some time off, but you can also go there and actually tee off for Boys and Girls Club of Thurston County. The Department of Corrections is having a golf tournament on August 5th. That will benefit the IF Project and Fair Start, two organizations that help integrate offenders back into the communities. Follow us on Twitter, and if you ever feel the need to tweet us a question that we will read on the podcast. I'm very disappointed in our Twitter followers. Nobody tweeted at us last time.
No, not a single one.
Yeah. You can do that at WaStateCFD. Same with our Facebook page. We're also on Instagram. We are a really cool teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're really
teenagers
awesome.
Would love us if they knew about us.
That's right, if they knew about us.
So our next podcast is going to air July 14th, and it is Independence Day was happening, so we're going to talk civics engagement, constitutional law.
Okay.
Human rights kind of issues again.
Oh, sweet. more light fodder.
Yeah,
right?
I mean,
really, really light topics we like
we
to
We do
talk
like
here.
To go with the light, frivolous kind of thing.
Sure, sure. So we hope you enjoyed the podcast. This is Podcast for Good. I'm Philip Kerrigan.
I'm Heather Lucas.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.